Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. When I was in graduate school, I wrote a 50-page research paper about clocks in the Ottoman Empire. Now, depending on how horrifying you find the idea of doing something like that to be, is a good litmus test on whether or not you should do a graduate program in history. The research I did, I'm sure it was very dry, but it wasn't just a book report about different clocks that appeared in the empire. What I discovered is that clocks reveal all sorts of very interesting things about human civilization. First of all, there's a question of why technology appears in the first place. The phrase, necessity is the mother of invention, is sometimes true. Some theorists think that the reason that you see clock towers appear in medieval Europe is because as cities are growing and mercantilism takes hold, timekeepers need a way to commodify time and pay people for a job that takes less than a day, but more than an instant, so you need to develop something like an hourly wage. However, the earliest clocks were very inaccurate, and until the invention of the pendulum, clocks had to be reset so often that they really weren't good for timekeeping. So, why did they appear? Other historians think that they were useful mechanical curiosities. Wealthy princes and kings and emperors would gift each other clocks, so they didn't appear to fill a technological vacuum, but became timekeepers as sort of happenstance. The second feature of understanding clocks is that they are a good way to articulate the concept of the social construction of technology. This is a term that researchers came up with in the 1980s that shows that technology in a society doesn't develop in a vacuum. There's not only one way to develop a plane or a car, but it develops to fill a social need. So in medieval European civilization, timekeeping is useful so that monks know the different prayers of the hours and what time they're supposed to do them. In the Islamic Middle East, the five times of prayer are dictated not according to a 24-hour system, but according to the position of the sun in the sky. So your third prayer of the day could be 1 minute earlier or later than your prayer that you did yesterday, and you need an accurate timekeeping method to keep track of this. Two different solutions for two different societies. And the third interesting feature of clocks and timekeeping, it's eventually what made long-distance travel possible. In the age of discovery, one of the biggest problems that overseas empires had to contend with was being able to figure out your longitude, your location east or west of your home port. Your location north and south was easy, you just needed a compass and a sextant, but longitude wasn't really figured out until you had accurate timekeeping devices that weren't developed until the 1700s. Once this was figured out, you now had a primitive sort of GPS and you could determine your location anywhere on the globe. Later, in the 20th century, with the development of digital timekeeping devices and also atomic clocks, GPS becomes possible. So our modern lives are ruled by clocks and watches, everything from smartphone apps to calendar programs. But while the gadgets may be new, the drive to measure and master time is anything but. This is a story that traces its path from Stonehenge to your smartphone. To delve into this topic is today's guest, Chad Orzel. He's a physics professor who's also the author of the book A Brief History of Timekeeping. The desire for ever better timekeeping has spurred technological innovation and sparked theories that radically reshape our understanding of the universe and also our place within it. It even predates written language. Ancient solstice markers, which still work 5,000 years later, depended on basic astrophysics of our solar system. Later, mechanical clocks developed due to Newtonian physics. The precise atomic timekeeping that enables GPS hinges on the predictable oddities of quantum mechanics. In this episode, Chad and I discuss the delicate negotiations that involved the Gregorian calendar reform, the unique system employed by the Maya, and why people thought the world would end in 2012, and how the problem of synchronizing clocks at different locations required us to abandon the idea of time as an absolute and universal quantity, which Einstein explained in his theory of relativity. So the story of clocks isn't just a story about sundials, sandglasses, and mechanical clocks, but also the politics of calendars and time zones, the philosophy of measurement, and the nature of space and time itself. A lot to unpack here, so if nothing else you'll see in this episode, there's a lot more to the simple clock than we give it credit for. I hope you enjoy this discussion with Chad Orzel. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I once wrote a 50-page research paper on clocks, which if that sounds miserable, then don't do a graduate study in history. But there was an interesting question that scholars were arguing about when it came to the history of timekeeping. Specifically, when we're talking about the appearance of mechanical clocks in medieval and late medieval Europe. And when they first appear, they're not accurate timekeepers. So the question is, did the need for timekeeping in medieval society cause clocks to appear even when they didn't really work well? Because you have the growth of towns and mercantilism, and people want to mark time more accurately than a simple day because they have to pay people? Or did the appearance of clocks as something you would give as a fancy gift to a prince or a king, or in town squares in the Middle Ages, and people saw them and they looked up at them and thought, you know, we already have these clocks, why don't we make them more accurate? Why did clocks appear? There's a chicken and egg question. So what have you found?
So specifically, if you're talking about mechanical clocks, right, they didn't completely appear out of nowhere, right? There were water clocks were sort of the standard high precision timekeepers up into the 1600s. I mean, Galileo Galilei, when he's doing his experiments on pendulums that eventually lead to the idea of a pendulum clock that becomes the most accurate mechanical, the really truly first accurate mechanical timekeepers. When he was doing his experiments, he was timing things using a water clock, because that was fairly advanced technology, and they were very reliable and repeatable, you know, for making small time measurements. So these existed, and mechanical clocks, the origin of them is a little murky, but probably they came out of sort of the spring-driven displays that were triggered by water clocks. So a thing you could do with a water clock is have sort of a float that would push up as the container filled with water, and, you know, the height of some arrow on it would indicate what time it was. But you could also like put a little knob on there that would kick, say, release a weight to fall. And as it falls, turn some gears that would make figures, you know, dance around or ring bells or do things like that. And these sort of mechanically driven displays that were triggered by water clocks then led people to think, you know, wait a minute, could we dispense with the water part of this and just use the falling weight to drive gears to do some timekeeping in the absence of the water? And so to some degree, this seems to have come out of like just the human impulse to tinker with things, right? And people playing around with these displays then kind of get the idea of, oh, maybe this could be the clock without all the water stuff. And it also solves, you know, minor problem, which is in the northern parts of Europe, right? Water clocks are a problem because they freeze, right? You know, if you are consistently getting really cold temperatures, then water clocks are a problem, which, you know, mechanical clocks fixes that. So even though they weren't terribly accurate, they were interesting and useful in that sense. Now, people who wanted to keep accurate time would use water clocks well up into the 1600s. And you checked all of this stuff, you know, everybody checked all this against astronomical observations. So you would look at what time does certain stars rise and things like that. And you set your clocks based on that sort of event. And that's what told you sort of the base, what time it was. And then these mechanical or otherwise clocks were sort of keeping time around that, right, in between those events.
It is a thorny mechanical challenge, but I've been impressed at the technological ingenuity in the Middle Ages of developing clocks, which I think is some of the most impressive technology of this era, where in monasteries, they use, like you said, water clocks and sundials, but also astrolabes and quadrants to find out the different periods of prayer. Same in the Islamic world, where you have a mulakitane, which is like a time house, I guess you could say, where they're trying to determine specific times of call to prayer that are based on different environmental factors. What are some different, I don't know, medieval technologies when it came to timekeeping that you think would impress people that don't know much about this era?
I think certainly the sophistication of the astronomy that was going on at the time is something that I don't think people appreciate. There's actually a very good recent book by Seb Falk called The Light Ages, which is sort of framed around the life of a medieval monk who designed a new instrument for making astronomical predictions. And there's actually a very sophisticated science and mathematics that went into things like astrolabes and these other devices that they had for measuring the positions of stars and planets and tracking what time it was that way. So I think that's one of the things that people don't understand as much as maybe we should. People think of it's, you know, just like horoscopes and superstition. Like, there was a lot going on of activity there. And then you get into the mechanical clocks, and you know, it's very rapid that people are developing clocks that are kind of, you know, impressive. They get very small very quickly. I mean, they're not really good, but people had sort of pocket watch sort of things, you know, in the 1500s. They didn't keep very accurate time, but it was a like really cool toy and something that people could make almost immediately. And so there's a huge amount of ingenuity that goes into the development of those things as well. One of the coolest things is if you get outside of Europe, it's around 1100 that there's the tower clock of Suzong in China. It's this really interesting hybrid of a mechanical clock and a water clock, that you have this massive wheel that's driven by the flow of water, and this clever arrangement so that there are sort of scoops at the ends of the wheel that fill up with water. When they reach a certain point, it lets the wheel turn one notch, and that drives gear work that, you know, that turns a celestial globe and powers, like, you know, modern type clock displays. It displays the time. There's spring driven figures that show up and do little displays to mark the hours and so on. So people, you know, in ages when we don't think of there being really high tech, had some really interesting things going on.
Right. We don't have to wait for Leonardo da Vinci to show up, because some of these astronomical clocks could take years to cycle through their calculations, because they're predicting eclipses, they're showing the phases of the moon, planets, everything else. It's amazing. Well, we started with the Middle Ages, but of course, the story begins much earlier, as you point out. So what is the origin and purpose of timekeeping in human history? Because some of our oldest structures are used to, say, mark the summer solstice 5,000 years ago. So what was the purpose of this in ancient civilizations?
The biggest purpose for keeping track of time initially, and you know, this goes back, you know, thousands, maybe even tens of thousands of years, is just to keep track of the seasons and to know, like, sort of where you are in the calendar. So some of the oldest and most spectacular clock-like structures are solstice markers, specifically around the winter solstice, which is the shortest day of the year. And that's the point where, you know, things have gotten as bad as they're going to get from the standpoint of an agrarian society. And you know, okay, this is when the days are going to start getting longer again, and things are going to start getting better. And this is when, you know, we know we're headed towards spring. And, you know, if you're dependent on hunting and gathering, or even, you know, planting and harvesting to get the food you need to live, that's critically important information to have. And so you need the ability to keep track of, okay, what time is it in the course of a year, right? On the scale of, you know, are we closer to spring than fall? And knowing, you know, when is the time when you want to go out there and start planting stuff? When is the time when you, you know, should expect certain animals to start to be more common so that you can hunt them, and all that kind of thing? Is that's really the starting place for this. And it's, you know, it becomes a thing that people sink an enormous amount of effort into, because it's literally a question of life and death at that point.
Right. I mean, their entire economy, really their entire way of life, is built around knowing this information. And that's another important point, too, because in the age of discovery, one of the most important scientific advances that different governments are looking for is being able to solve the problem of determining longitude, where you are north to south on ship. Mm-hmm. East to west, you can determine pretty well with astronomy and the tools they had there, but longitude is a different matter altogether.
Other way around.
Right. So can you tell me about this problem, why it was so important to solve and how it was finally solved?
Right. So the trick is, if you're thinking about time as on a global scale, the starting point for thinking about time is the motion of the sun across the sky. And, you know, noon is when it's at its highest point that it's going to reach. But that comes at different times. That event of the sun reaching its zenith comes at different times at different places on the globe. So as you move east to west, if, you know, you're starting in London, the sun is directly overhead in London at some time. But, you know, it's 4 or 5 hours later when you're in the New World, right? So you're in the U.S. and Canada, the sun's reaching the zenith, you know, 5 hours later than it did in London. That complicates the timekeeping. That also makes it a matter of importance for navigation, right? If you know the difference between when was the sun directly overhead in London versus when is the sun directly overhead where we are now, then that tells you your position on the Earth relative to London, how far you've gone east or west. And so that difference in longitude is intimately connected to the difference in time. The problem is getting from London to the US or Canada, right? You got to cross the Atlantic Ocean, and for, you know, weeks, months, you're on a ship that's moving and, you know, pretty much constantly moving. It's rocking. The weather conditions are pretty terrible. So keeping track of what time it is from the deck of a ship at the level of precision you need to know where you are on your journey, that's a really hard problem to solve. So there's two approaches that people take to solving that problem. The one that seems more obvious now is, you know, just make a really good clock. You know, if you can make a timekeeper of sufficient quality that it will keep accurate time through the journey, then, you know, you just set it to London time and then, you know, carry it with you. And anytime you need to know where you are, you say, well, right now in London, it's this time. And then you look up at the sky and, you know, where's the position of the sun? Okay. You know, the sun is, you know, reaching its zenith at this time in London, which means we're this far east or west. That's a really challenging technological problem in terms of making a clock that will hold up to the conditions on shipboard. And that ends up being solved by initially a guy named John Harrison, does this in the mid 1700s, and then has a long protracted argument with the Board of Longitude that was offering a prize for somebody making a method to measure longitude. His main competition was going back to sort of the older idea of looking at something in the sky and using that to tell you what time it is. And then the problem you have is, you know, again, this is hard to do from shipboard. So you want something really obvious, right? Something big and easy to spot. And what ends up working is the moon. Right. If you look at the position of the moon in the sky, what stars it's closest to, that can tell you what time it is. Right. You can make a set of tables that say, all right, at this time in London, then the, you know, the moon will be next to this star. And if you measure that, you know, the distance from that star to the moon, that tells you what time it is, what time it should be in London. And then you can compare that to your local time and say, okay, so this allows us to calculate longitude. Doing that also turns out to be a really hard problem. And it's a really hard theoretical problem. Because if you're going to do this, right, you need to be able to predict where is the moon going to be months and years in advance, and developing the science needed for that turns out to be really hard. It comes out of the work of Isaac Newton on his theory of gravity, which explains the orbits of the planets and eventually the moon. And a bunch of the greatest scientists in the 1700s scientists and mathematicians end up getting involved in this, including Leonard Euler. But the final piece of it is the grunt work that's done by a guy named Tobias Meyer, who just, you know, makes a bunch of really careful observations of the moon, uses these formulas that were developed by Euler and Clairaut, and then generates sort of a table of where is the moon going to be at various times. And that turns out to be a cheaper alternative to making a really good clock. Harrison's watches that he made to keep time on ship work brilliantly, but they're tremendously expensive. They cost more than the ship initially. And so, whereas these tables and a sextant cost way less than that. So you can, you know, get a copy of these lunar tables. You can get a simple sextant for measuring the distance between the moon and some star. And that will enable you to tell your longitude well enough for navigational purposes. So it works out really nicely. And so these two things sort of develop in parallel through the 1700s. And that's what ends up solving the problem of being able to navigate over sort of a global scale.
It's interesting because we see a lot of parallels with that and GPS and anyone being able to accurately determine their position, get driving directions. What effect does this have once the problem is solved and you can somewhat reliably determine your position on a ship in the middle of the ocean?
Yeah, this coincides with really the rise of your like really globe spanning empires. I mean, it's already happening in the early 1700s that, you know, the European powers are sort of carving up the whole world. But it gets much easier to do because, you know, you can have a better idea of how far do I still have to sail. There are these famous stories from before the lunar tables and watches were made up of people, you know, sailing. You know, the way you would deal with the inability to accurately measure longitude is you could determine your latitude from the height of the sun, and then you just sort of stay at that latitude and sail east or sail west and, you know, go for as long as it takes until you hit something you recognize. You know, there are stories, though, of people deciding doing that and then saying, oh, God, we've been, you know, sailing for 2 weeks that we should have already reached this thing, we must have been in the wrong place, and let's turn around and go back and end up, you know, running out of food and things like that. Once you have a more solid idea of your position, then these sort of long voyages become more practical and it becomes easier to sort of really get kind of the global trade going that makes, you know, the British Empire at its peak the thing that it was. And so that ability to navigate is really, really critical.
Right. We're seeing at the time of this recording how fickle our supply chain can be. So imagine how much more vulnerable it would be if you had ships that couldn't have anything in the way of an accurate timetable. But now they can.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And you know, it's fascinating to read some of these things where, you know, people are basically, you invest in, you know, international shipping at that time. It's like, you know, playing roulette, right? You're laying down a whole bunch of money to buy a ship. And you're hoping it's going to make it to India and back. And it's, you know, it's months and months not knowing, did the ship get to where it was supposed to be going, you know, and what's happening. So people lose fortunes, you know, sort of bankrolling these expeditions that just vanish because nobody knows where they are. And that's a huge problem that gets, you know, it doesn't completely go away, but it gets a little more tractable as you get into the age where people can navigate more reliably. And nowadays, you know, everybody knows where everything is, right? Because we have the GPS system, which again is based in timekeeping technology.
One thing you touch on is how clocks differ from each other and how these differences refine our models of time. And when I was looking at clocks in the Ottoman Empire a long time ago in my graduate program, I read a very interesting collective volume called The Social Construction of Technological Systems. And something that the authors note is scientific determinism of technology isn't as set as we might think. And the point being that some might assume that, well, cars could only look one way, planes can only look one way, clocks could have only turned out one way with, you know, 12 numbers, but that's not necessarily the case. And when I was looking at the example of the Ottoman Empire, in addition to the numbers being Arabic numerals, for a long time, I mean, really until the late 19th, early 20th centuries, wealthy Ottomans who had clocks would reset them to midnight when the sun went down. So they would use the 12 hours, the hours would sort of bend and flex according to environmental conditions because they thought, well, hours should represent the environmental conditions of sunrise and sunset, not this fixed system. And there were very talented clockmakers who could develop pocket watches that could tell you the times of the call to prayer throughout the year. And this is something that is constantly changing from day to day based on the position of the sun. So clocks were really refashioned to fit the particular needs of that civilization. Not that clocks had to be the exact same way throughout the planet based on different laws of physics. So can you talk about that, about how clocks are different from each other and how this has informed our idea of time?
Yeah, this is a fascinating thing. And this is really, you know, traditionally, I mean, where tradition is going back, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 years, right? People thought of the hours as, you know, there's some number of hours of daylight and the same number of hours of darkness. And those hours get, you know, longer and shorter as you go through the year. So, you know, the daylight hours are longer in the summer and shorter in the winter, and vice versa for the nighttime hours. My favorite example of this is actually from Japan. In the Tokugawa period, they had these clocks that they got based on European mechanical clocks, but they were still using a system where there is a fixed number of hours, you know, of daylight and hours of night. And so there were people whose job it was to go around, you know, the nobles' palaces. They would go around at, you know, sunrise and sunset and adjust the clock so it would tick at a different rate during the day than at night. And, you know, that was a job, and they had tables of how do you, you know, lengthen and shorten the pendulum for particular days of the year. That's a system that, you know, is perfectly valid as a social matter. It's just a matter of convention. So, you know, as clocks got better and got into pendulum-based timekeeping, which can be accurate to, you know, seconds per day, that sort of level, you know, it's very fiddly to keep readjusting that to make daylight hours and nighttime hours longer or shorter. So Europeans sort of drifted into this system of, like, you know what, let's just make all of the hours exactly the same. And then we just change the time when we think of sunrise and sunset, not try and, you know, mess around with the clocks so that they always have the sun rising and setting at the same time. And that's another perfectly valid choice you can make about how you define time. Sort of the ultimate example of this is something that, you know, happens every year, that every year people complain about, which is the daylight savings time, the changing of the clocks in early November and in March in the US. And that's another of these things that's purely a matter of convention, right? We've decided to say that, you know, everywhere in these broad time zones is exactly the same time, even though the sun's at different positions in the sky. You know, if you look in, you know, eastern Maine and western, you know, Ohio or Indiana, the sun's in very different places, even though both of those are in the eastern time zone. We've decided as a matter of convention that just for convenience, we're going to say that everybody in this broad band of longitude is experiencing the same time. And we've also decided that we'll arbitrarily shift what time it is by an hour, you know, one way or the other in the spring and the fall, because that just happens to be more convenient for, you know, allowing us to have really long days. You have the sun set very late in the summer so that we've got daylight for much longer. It's purely a matter of social convention, what time we say it is.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky?
In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's interesting how much people can be wedded to their social convention, even if we think it doesn't make sense. And I remember reading about Ottomans who in the 19th century, they had to keep both their local time, but then the standard European time conventions because of international railroad tables and postal systems and other things. And when they completely switched to the 24-hour clock in the beginning of the Turkish Republic, many of them complained that, oh, I remember when 12 o'clock meant sundown, and I had a sort of a connection to my clock where it meant something emotionally when I looked at it. And now it doesn't mean anything. They sort of detested this new system. And are there other things too that you see outside of just 24 hours, along with calendars and time zones that have entered into the social and political outside of the technological?
I think one of the most interesting examples is, so, you know, if you look at most of the cultures that we have really good records of are all kind of in contact with each other, sort of Europe and Asia, and everybody kind of ended up at some multiple of 12 sort of thing. So, you know, Europe and also China and Japan, right, tend to divide things into sets of 12 hours in a day and 20, you know, that kind of thing. So that's pretty common because they're all sort of talking to each other. The really fascinating one is the Mayan calendar, which got a whole bunch of buzz about 10 years ago because there was this loony idea that there were these cycles that were coming to an end in 2012 and, you know, the world was going to change. And that really is maybe the most dramatic thing for demonstrating the sort of arbitrariness of this, in that they have this series of interlocking cycles that are units of, they have a time unit that's 20 days, and then there are 13 of those that go by. So there's this cycle of 260 days, which doesn't match anything in particular that we think of as a natural cycle of time. And so it's a really interesting question, like, what is it that they found this really fundamental, and lots of their timekeeping is based on this odd unit of days. And, you know, why did they do that? There's some suggestion that it has to do with astronomy in the tropics, that the length of their sort of growing season is demarcated by the dates when the sun at noon is truly directly overhead, because they're in the tropics and there is a time when the sun, you know, is right at the center of the sky at noon. And those are separated by around 260 days at a particular latitude where the Maya were located. But nobody's really sure what's going on there. And so they had this extremely different calendar system that, you know, was extremely accurate. They maintained it very carefully. They made these, you know, extremely elaborate and very accurate astronomical tables predicting the rising and setting of planets, all based around this unit of 200 and something days that doesn't match up to anything that we think of as important. So that's really the most dramatic example of, and I think you get that dramatic difference between their basis of time and, you know, what we think of from European-based systems, because, you know, they were in, you know, separated by big oceans on both sides from everybody else in Eurasia, who's sort of all kind of cribbing from the Babylonians and ending up with, you know, 12-hour days and dividing things up in the same sort of way. So it's fascinating to see, you know, how different you can end up with when people are really totally independently developing their time systems.
Well, I think of mechanical clocks as one of the most impressive pre-digital technologies. And it is it's amazing how accurate they could be, but they could, of course, never compete with digital. So getting into digital technologies, for you as a physicist, what sort of change and what sort of benefit did it mean to have digital timekeeping?
So, you know, what happens as your time gets better and better, right? There's this kind of bootstrapping process that goes on, that people first realize that, well, the length of the day changes at different points in the year. So we have to do something a little more sophisticated than just a really simple sundial. We have to have sort of these tables of how does the year change as we go. And then you go to mechanical clocks, and that sort of gets you away from, as we were saying earlier, gets you away from the fixing the times of sunrise and sunset and saying, okay, we're going to have fixed length hours and use that as a basis of time. As you get to really the pinnacle of sort of mechanical pendulum driven clocks in the early 20th century, it starts to become obvious that the rate of the Earth's rotation isn't perfectly uniform. The Earth is gradually slowing down sort of over an extremely long time scale. There's a slowing trend, but also sometimes it speeds up a little bit and that sort of thing. And so people notice this and, you know, have to devise a new basis for time for what we call a second based on, you know, not saying anymore, we can't rely on the motion of the sun because now we have these pendulum clocks that are more reliable. As you get to electronic timekeeping, that becomes even more pronounced. In the early 20th century, they figure out how to make quartz clocks. And so if you get a quartz crystal, that's an extremely rigid material, and you can set it into oscillation with an electronic signal, so it'll vibrate back and forth at a very regular rate. You can also read out the position of the thing electronically using the same effect that starts it oscillating. So you can make these quartz oscillators that are just phenomenally good. They're better than any pendulum clock, any kind of mechanical clock, and that gets you still better. And then people say, okay, now we really need to rethink this. But those quartz clocks still have kind of moving parts in them, right? You still have to manufacture a little tuning fork shaped thing that's, you know, going to be a particular size and particular shape and vibrate. And, you know, the uniformity of those is an issue. So the ultimate thing that we've decided as our current standard of time is to go to something that has no moving parts. And the oscillation we look at is actually the oscillation of light. And so light, we know, is a wave that has a characteristic frequency. You know, you can count those oscillations and treat that as the ticking of your clock. And so our current standard of time is, we say that 1 second is 9,192,631,770 oscillations of the light that's absorbed and emitted when cesium atoms move between two particular energy states. That is a spectacularly good clock, at least potentially, because first of all, the light is the only thing moving, right? And that doesn't have any physical moving parts that can wear out or break down, anything like that. And then you reference it to the cesium atoms, and every cesium atom in the universe is identical to every other cesium atom in the universe. So if you've got light that the cesium atom you have wants to absorb, you know that you're getting exactly the same frequency as somebody else, no matter where they are with their cesium atom that's looking at the light that it wants to absorb. And so it's a more truly universal basis for timekeeping that can be, you know, super reliable. The downside is now you've got a clock that ticks 9.1 billion times a second. So that's a little bit of a challenge. But in World War II, that's kind of in the frequency range where radar operates. And so there's a huge amount of technology developed to generate and measure these frequencies incredibly accurately in World War II. And that makes it feasible to do these atomic clocks. And so really the atoms are a reference that's establishing a frequency of light. And the thing that's ticking is actually a microwave oscillator that you can convert to a once a second digital signal using a bunch of electronics. And that gets you clocks that are really just spectacularly good. Top of the line cesium clocks these days are good to, you know, they would need to run continuously for something like a billion years before they would gain or lose 1 second. So they're really just phenomenally good clocks.
Every few years, I read something that, say, a U.S. Naval Research Laboratory develops a more accurate atomic clock. And actually, in relation to this interview, I just did a search on Google News, and there was a clock from MIT. And the quote says that it developed an atomic clock so accurate that if state-of-the-art atomic clocks were adapted to measure entangled atoms the way the MIT setup does, their timing would improve such that over the entire age of the universe, the clocks would be less than 100 milliseconds off. Well, over 12 billion years, that's pretty good. So hats off to you. Now, for me as a layman, why? What does that mean? What is the point?
Right. So the big application of this is actually something we mentioned earlier, which is GPS. So the global positioning system consists of a bunch of satellites that contain cesium atomic clocks. And those clocks broadcast a time signal saying what satellite it is and what time it is according to the clock on that satellite. And the way the system works is your phone or the GPS receiver in your car picks up the signal from several of these satellites. And looking at the difference, right, those satellites are in different positions. So the light traveling from the satellite to your car or your phone takes different amounts of time. By looking at the difference in the different clocks that it's picking up, it can convert that to a distance and say, okay, you're this far away from satellite 123, you're, you know, this far away from satellite 224, right? And that picks out a particular point on the surface of the Earth. So the analogy I use is, like, I live in Schenectady, New York, which is not a place that lots of people are super familiar with. But I can locate it for people by saying, well, we're about 3 hours away from Boston, which puts you somewhere on a circle that's about 180 miles in radius, centered on Boston. And I can say we're about 3 hours drive from New York, which puts you on a 180 mile radius circle centered on New York. There's only two places on the surface of the Earth where those two circles intersect. One of them is Schenectady, the other is in the North Atlantic. And so, you know, given that information, you can kind of figure out where we are. If you really need to nail it down, we can also say that we're 4 hours away from Montreal. And those three circles, right, then there's exactly one point on the surface of the Earth where all of those intersect, and that's Schenectady. That's the same thing that's going on with your GPS receiver. It's saying, okay, we're this distance away from these satellites whose orbits are extremely well known and carefully maintained. And that allows you to locate yourself on the surface of the Earth at a unique position. Now, if you want to do that at a useful degree, right, the time difference is coming because the radio waves from the satellite travel at the speed of light. Light moves about a foot in a nanosecond. So if you want to know where you are on the surface of the Earth well enough to be able to navigate in your car, right, you need to know your position to within, you know, 20, 30 feet. You need to know the time to within 20, 30 nanoseconds. You need to know that that's going to be reliable. So the GPS system is something that's really only possible using atomic clocks because they have that level of precision. You can put atomic clocks in the satellite that will keep time accurate to nanoseconds per year, and that will enable you to do the navigation that you want to do using these signals from these satellites. So GPS is something that's ultimately enabled by having this incredibly precise atomic timekeeping.
Something else you note about GPS is that it hinges on the predictable oddities of quantum mechanics. What does that mean?
So the way that these clocks work is by looking at the frequency of light that's absorbed and emitted as cesium atoms move between two states. And this is something that's determined by quantum physics. It's actually one of the ways into quantum physics is noticing that, you know, if you have a collection of atoms of a particular element, right, if you get them hot, like you burn them in a flame or you run an electric current through them, make a plasma, you get light of a unique set of discrete colors. If you take that, you know, you spread it out with a prism, look at it through a diffraction grating, you see particular colors. You know, a neon light has this characteristic red color. If you make a bulb filled with some different gas, you'll see a different color. Those states indicate that there are within the atom certain allowed energies that the electrons orbiting the nucleus can take on. And that is a very surprising phenomenon. You know, if you think about planets in the solar system, there's nothing restricting planets in the solar system to any particular distance from the sun. We've seen this in, you know, there's thousands upon thousands of exoplanets that we've observed now. You know, those can orbits can be any size and shape that you like. But that's not true if you're putting an electron in orbit around an atom. That an electron orbiting an atom can only take on certain very particular collections of properties. And those are determined by quantum mechanics. You can think of it as the wave nature of the electrons limited to these discrete states. That's what gives you particular states that the light drives the atom back and forth between. And that's the basis for an atomic clock, is saying that, okay, I know that a cesium atom has these two energy states that are separated by this much energy. And to move from one to the other, it has to either absorb or emit light that has a very particular frequency, and then I can use that frequency as the basis for making a clock. So fundamentally, these atomic clocks depend on the weird properties of quantum physics, the fact that electrons have wave nature that makes them behave not like, you know, planets orbiting the sun, but these weird quantum objects that can only occupy certain discrete states.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
Once in a generation, a podcast comes along with the power and eloquence to inspire us all.
This show will entertain you while you wait for that one. Join two best friends, author and former history teacher John Driver and comedian Johnny W. for hilarious and authentic conversations about life, history, culture, faith, and everything in between.
You can listen to Talk About That wherever you find your podcasts or at lifeaudio.com.
As an aside, for you as a physicist, are there things about quantum mechanics and popular culture that drive you crazy? So, for example, there's a few things that have seeped into the public consciousness, although they're probably misunderstood. There's entanglement. And believe it or not, I think I heard, I found a clip on YouTube of two people talking on a wellness podcast about how when we feel positive about each other, that causes entanglement. So this is Deepak Chopra stuff, or existing in two states at the same time. So quantum computers could allow incredible computations in the future that could completely break encryption as we know it. But then let's take on, again, this bizarre misunderstanding where people think, well, you know, as an enlightened beings, we can, you know, new age gobbledygook stuff about a superposition. So how do you handle that as a physicist when you hear people completely butcher the idea of quantum mechanics?
Yeah, it's a problem. What's frustrating about it is, you know, the stuff is fascinatingly weird, right? You have this property of, you know, electrons behave like particles and waves at the same time. And that's completely real, right? We can do these, you know, spectacularly beautiful experiments that demonstrate these properties in beautiful, clear ways and show that the world really is at a fundamental level very, very strange. What ends up happening, though, is, you know, people will latch onto this as sort of a way to try and get things that they want to be true. And it really doesn't, they just really don't pan out. And like a lot of this is kind of wish casting, is sort of saying that, well, you know, quantum mechanics has these anti-realist properties where, you know, reality is what you measure it to be. So if we just choose to measure reality to be something different than it is, it, you know, then we change the world around us. You know, that's really frustrating because it ends up obscuring the real science that, you know, that we can genuinely show that this stuff is true on a fundamental level. And it does it, you know, often in the service of bad ends, right? This is, you know, people are using this weirdness to try and sell something to people who aren't as informed about it as physicists are. And, you know, that's really frustrating. You don't like seeing people get bilked out of, you know, their hard-earned income by people who are promising scams. You know, the ultimate solution to this is you know, two things. One, you know, part of why I do what I do, writing books about science for non-scientists, is to try and help people be a little more informed about this, to know that, okay, entanglement is a real thing. Entanglement does not explain ESP, right? Like, you know, entanglement's a real thing, ESP, not real. And, you know, there's a whole list of reasons why that is. And you can lay that out and explain that to people. The other more general thing I would say is that, you know, it's useful for people to keep in mind that, you know, one of the most fundamental principles of the universe that you should always keep in mind is that anything that sounds too good to be true probably is, right? That, you know, if somebody's telling you something, it's like, wow, that's completely, you know, like you can just effortlessly, you know, by, you know, knowing this secret method, you can, you know, force reality and bend it to your will. No, you can't, right? That's not based in science. If someone's telling you that something, you can do something magical, they're almost certainly lying to you. And, you know, that doesn't change whether the basis they're claiming for it is, you know, ancient Egyptian, you know, mystical whatnot or quantum mechanics, right? If it sounds like hooey, it almost certainly is.
Speaking of which, I'd like to do a break for a host read of my new supplement line that allows you to achieve entanglement. Yes. And move anything on Earth with telekinesis through entanglement. So just let me take
move that there. Move that with your mind. Right. Yeah. One of my counters for that is, like, you know, if quantum mechanics really allowed you to, you know, attract wealth and power just by, you know, meditating and wishing for it hard enough, like, you know, the physicists would not work nearly as hard as we do to get research funding. Right. If you could, you know, you just go down to the local store and, you know, buy a lottery ticket and wish it into, you know, your $400 million individual grant. So,
yeah, it's not as if you and your colleagues are huddling together, upset that the secret has exposed what you're trying to hide from the rest of the world.
Right.
Well, we joke about this, but it's interesting because this does connect much earlier periods in history, because quantum mechanics is something that most people barely understand. It's incredibly complicated, yet in the very new future, this could have impact on billions, if not many billions of dollars in the global economy, because it's coming up with things like encryption and calculating things in biology that classical computers don't replicate very well. And it could lead to all sorts of different scientific discoveries. So even though it's not well understood, it could have incredible bearing on our economy and our society. And in a way, that's not too different from these earlier discoveries that you were talking about, with an accurate location for a ship that many people in the Renaissance or the Enlightenment era couldn't rebuild one of these clocks, but they knew that it was having an incredible impact on imports and exports and everything else. So I guess this gets back to one of the root questions in your book, and that's, what do clocks and, I suppose, timekeeping devices in general tell us about space and time itself?
Yeah. So one of the fascinating things that comes out of thinking about space and time is, you know, you have this issue of coordinating time over very large distances, right? And this is the fundamental problem of measuring longitude is you want to know what time is it in London and also what time is it in New York, you know, kind of at the same time. And people to do these longitude measurements put a lot of thought into how do you synchronize these clocks over very large distances. And one of the things that turns out you have to do is take into account the time for the signal to go from one to the other. So, you know, if you want to measure the longitude difference between New York and London, it's not enough to just send a signal one way saying, okay, it's noon in London. And, you know, you get that signal in New York and say, okay, I set my clock to noon, because it takes some time for that signal to travel over the telegraph cable separating the two cities. If you don't account for that time, you get answers that are a little bit wrong, right? If you're going west to east, it seems like it takes, you know, a little bit less time to get there. If you're going east to west, it seems like it takes a little bit more time. And those two signals, those two methods give you two different answers for the longitude difference. What you have to do is take your clocks and send a signal, say, you know, west to east, saying, okay, it was noon, you know, I sent this signal at noon. And then when it arrives, they send a signal back. And then you can measure the round trip time and subtract half of that time from your time measurements. And that enables you to synchronize these clocks over wider distances. Well, it turns out, though, if you start to think carefully about that, that looks very different if the two people who are doing the clock synchronization are moving, right? If they're moving west to east, then what happens, someone standing still watching them go by will see that synchronization process happen a little bit different. They'll see in one direction, the signal is traveling towards someone who's running away from it, so it's going to take longer to get there. In the other direction, the signal is headed towards someone who's coming toward it, so it's going to take less time. And the synchronization that's done for two people who are moving, they'll think they've synchronized their clocks perfectly, a person standing still watching them go by will say, no, those are out of sync because you did it wrong, right? Your timing is off because you're moving relative to me. That leads directly to the theory of relativity, as it turns out, because you know, you start thinking about synchronization of clocks that are moving, you realize the only way you can synchronize clocks is by doing some sort of sending signals back and forth. And that sending signals back and forth process is going to look different to people who are moving in different ways, which leads you to the odd conclusion that it's actually impossible to say definitively what time it is. Because what time you think it is going to depend on how you and clocks that are synchronized with you are moving relative to somebody else and clocks that are synchronized with them as they move back and forth. That leads to a difference in the timing of events. It also leads to a change in observations of space. You think that the distances between objects are different. And the amazing thing about this is both groups of people are perfectly right. Right. Someone who says that they're standing still sees the moving person's clocks running slow, but the moving person, right, they're perfectly entitled to imagine themselves being at rest. And then the original person who was in the lab, it looks like their clocks are running slow. And so there's this symmetry to this. This ends up being, you know, sort of the core of the origin of the theory of relativity. This actually worked out first by George Fitzgerald, who's an Irish mathematician, and Hendrik Lorentz, who's a Dutch physicist and mathematician. And then Henri Poincaré gets into the game and explains it in terms of, you know, Lorentz and Fitzgerald had the idea that space needed to change and time needed to change a little bit to account for some other phenomena. Poincaré points out that this is all related to this synchronization of clocks problem. And then ultimately, this whole thing gets put into a really elegant framework by Albert Einstein in 1905, who points out that, you know, there's really nothing you can do that leads to any result other than what time you think it is depends on how you're moving. And that's the core of special relativity. So all of this comes out of, and there's the historian Peter Galison has a really interesting book called Einstein's Clocks, Poincaré's Maps, that points out that both of these guys who played a crucial role in the origin of relativity were deeply involved in timekeeping research, that Poincaré was on the board of longitude that was establishing time zones and measuring distances between things, so had to think about these issues very deeply. And Einstein was a patent clerk in Switzerland who, we don't know exactly what patents he reviewed, but you know, Switzerland is famous for clocks, and you know, there were just no end of schemes for synchronizing clocks going through the patent office in Switzerland. So Einstein would have been seeing this kind of thing in his daily life. And so probably, you know, this timekeeping issues play a really fundamental role in the origin of the theory of relativity.
Well, you don't have to convince me about the importance of clocks in the development of human civilization and the contribution to humanity's scientific understanding, but I hope this convinces a lot of listeners as well. And for those who want to get into the story more, and there's a lot more to it, the name of the book is A Brief History of Timekeeping. Chad, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. This was fun.
All right. That is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.